This is Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette, and it is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable when we get you up to date on the news that made headlines this week. Our panel today, Kevin Richert with Idaho Ed News, Harrison Berry with the Boise Weekly, and James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News. Hey there, guys.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Harrison, I would like to start with you because, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of things happening this week, but really the big story, the peaceful vigil that was held at the State House. But can we back up a little bit and let's start with some of the background around all of these protests that have been happening now for more than a week across the country. I am assuming that everyone knows about this. However, just in case someone lives under a rock, Harrison, let's get people up to date a bit. Are you there, Harrison? He was. All right. We are having an issue with that, so we will get back to him. So Kevin and Jimmy, while we figure out the technical issues with Harrison, let's start then with the far-reaching effects of the election results, because in the midst of all of the protests going on around the country and the vigil that happened here in Idaho, we were counting ballots from the primary election that actually happened in May. So Jimmy, can you start with, there were some upsets in this, but the reason why it took so long, frankly, to get election results after the primary.
Yeah, I mean, we had some technical difficulties there as well, just because the system had kind of been set up for in-person elections. It seems like the counties, which are responsible for counting their own votes, were inputting that data into kind of this older system that the Secretary of State's office was running, but they were then simultaneously trying to display that on this new system that they've been transitioning to. And so there were some issues there. If you were watching on election night, and typically what we do to kind of see how far they are, they being the county elections offices, are to finishing counting ballots, we kind of look at how many precincts have reported. And, you know, if they had counted one single vote from a precinct, some counties were reporting that as that whole precinct had reported. So we really didn't know until kind of the next day what the election results were. But it was a significant amount of turnout. I mean, we had 38.6%, I believe, you know, actually show up for this all absentee mail-in voting primary that we had, which, as far as I could tell, looking back at the records, was the biggest that we've had since 2000.
And you're right, Jimmy. It felt a little old school not having the results until almost the next morning, right?
Yeah. Yeah, just a little bit. We were kind of scrambling on the news side, like, how do we report this? You know, because certain counties actually did not post their results online, you know, some of the more rural and remote counties. So it was a little difficult to see there. But as Kevin and I think have written about, I mean, this was a very consequential primary with a huge victory for the right wing of the Republican Party.
But right, Jimmy, go ahead, Kevin. Go ahead.
And I was just going to say, I think that the consequences of this election and the technological glitches, they do intersect, because one of the most significant developments in the legislative primaries involved a race in Eastern Idaho. Carrie Hanks, a Freedom Foundation aligned former legislator, is going back to the legislature. She unseated a moderate legislator, Gerald Raymond, but the initial results released by the state, the Secretary of State's office, had Raymond winning. And there were contradictory numbers on the Secretary of State's own website. So you had to kind of dig in, and if you looked at the county by county numbers, which were actually the accurate numbers, Hanks did win. I believe the explanation was that there was a human error, that some of the numbers weren't transferred completely into the unofficial results that were posted on the Secretary of State's page. So it took until about midday Wednesday for us to really know who won that race. And it's not an insignificant race by any stretch.
Yeah, Secretary of State Lawrence Denny told me the reason for that was because the human error was they didn't include an entire county in those election results.
Which just happened to be Carrie Hanks' home county. So not surprisingly, she carried that county, and that's what swung the balance.
But with that being said, I mean, we don't know yet if we will have an all mail-in election for the general election come November. I mean, that's still up in the air. So did either of you have a chance to talk with the Secretary of State's office about these glitches? And I mean, you know, they've got some months now to hopefully get this process to work better and more efficiently.
Yeah, I spoke with him the day after the election. He said that he thinks a lot of the glitches are down to the fact that they were kind of using two systems simultaneously, whereas the new system should be online, I think he said, within a couple weeks now. And that includes a new voter registration system, which should alleviate some of the problems that we saw with people requesting ballots as well, even if we don't have an all mail-in ballot system, because they're moving that to the cloud, meaning they can just, you know, throw some money at it and, you know, have a new server logged on to take on that anticipated new traffic. So that was kind of the reasoning behind it is the answer that I got anyway.
I want to come back to the two of you in a minute, but we do have Harrison back with us. So Harrison, I want to go back to what I first mentioned in the beginning of the segment, and this is the protests that have been happening around the country, in particular the peaceful vigil that happened earlier this week here in Boise. Can you get us up to date about that? Because you attended that vigil, right? You covered it.
I did attend that. I also asked one of my writers to report on that as well. That was absolutely enormous. I'm sure there are lots of listeners who attended themselves or have heard about it. You know, an estimated 6,000 people did go to that. It was very moving. I think that we can safely say that a lot of people were able to contribute. It was just a fantastic chance for people to be able to sort of like reconnect and be able to mm-hmm. to sort of grieve on their own.
And can you talk a little bit about, I mean, this one, who the organizers were and all of that, because they were very specific about this being a vigil, but also a peaceful vigil, not a protest.
Yeah, and it was very much that. They did an excellent job of corralling some of that.
And we lost Harrison again. He is having some internet problems. This is what happens when things are live and we all are all still working remotely. So as we work on getting Harrison back, Jimmy, talk to us with the primary election results, with some of the upsets that happen, because like Representative Brian Zollinger, he lost his seat.
He did, yeah. And I mean, I think that was the main blow to kind of the right wing of the Republican Party that night. He lost by a little over 100 votes to Marco Erickson in Idaho Falls. But other than that, I mean, they got some big gains, especially in the Senate with Christy Zitto poised to take over that seat in November. She does have a general election Democrat challenger there. But that's to replace retiring Senator Burt Brackett. Kevin mentioned earlier, you had Carrie Hanks, a former lawmaker, unseating Gerald Raymond there. And she wasn't the only one. You had former Representative Ron Nate also taking out Britt Raybould. These were all in Eastern Idaho. Then you had Julie Yamamoto and Caldwell taking out Jerem Wagner. Bruce Skaug was unopposed to take over for Robert Anderst in Nampa, kind of staying in the Treasure Valley. You had Ben Adams, who's going to replace Gary Collins after a four-way race there, and former Ada County GOP Executive Director Greg Furch won a three-way race to take over for Megan Kiska. So a lot, people were celebrating, really, in the right wing of the Republican Party last night. They saw it as a huge, huge victory.
And then, Kevin, there were, of course, within this election, school district issues and all of that. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, I think one of the other big takeaways from Tuesday night, and in addition to the potential changes in the legislature, you had several big school elections, big ballot measures for schools fail, and the most significant one in our part of the state, and really the largest ballot measure any school was seeking on Tuesday night, West Ada was seeking a two-year, $28 million supplemental levy. It failed. It didn't get the simple majority needed to pass. And I think that this is one example where the heavy turnout was definitely a factor. You know, West Ada has had this supplemental levy on the books for several years. This wasn't going to be an increase in the levy. It was just going to be a continuation. These levies have to be approved every 2 years. And granted, the economy certainly had to play a role in what happened in West Ada, what happened with other school ballot measures. But one number just really blew me away when I was doing some analysis after the election. The last time West Ada had the supplemental levy on the ballot, it was March 2018. It was just the school election, so it was a standalone ballot issue. You had about 15,000 people vote, and it passed with a two-thirds majority, well above the simple majority it needed. Tuesday night, you had more than 46,000 people vote in this levy because it was on the same ballot with the primary. That's a huge difference in turnout, and I've got to think that that, in addition to the economic concerns, I think those two factors definitely contributed to what happened in West Ada.
So, Kevin, what does that ultimately mean then for the West Ada School District? I mean, they are the largest school district in the state.
It means they're hurting, what it means.
They're bursting at the seams. And then beyond that, we know all of the issues they had with trying to get online learning up and going.
Yeah, I don't really know what West Ada's next steps are going to be. That's something that we need to really get a handle on. But the levy itself, $14 million a year, accounts for about 5% of their annual budget. You factor in on top of that, Governor Little is telling all school districts to brace for a potential 5% budget holdback the beginning of next year. So, you know, that's about a 10% hit overall in West Ada's budget. And it comes at a time West Ada is at the bargaining table. They're trying to come up with a contract agreement with their teachers. It's a difficult time for West Ada. We're going to track that and try to get a better sense of where the district goes from here. But it's a tough go for West Ada, and it's going to be a tough go for other school districts. Middleton also had a supplemental levy fail the same week that their superintendent resigned abruptly. So Middleton was making all kinds of news, and not necessarily the way you want to make news if you're a school district.
So, Kevin, speaking of the Middleton superintendent resigning, as you said, that was not something that at least publicly we knew would happen. I mean, this person was not getting set to retire. I mean, it did seem to kind of come out of the blue.
Sharon Reberry had been there as superintendent for less than a year. Middleton is looking for another superintendent. This has been kind of a revolving door. And I think it's fair to say that that was probably a contributing factor in the failure of the supplemental levy in Middleton, just that there's been so much churn in the superintendent's office. If you recall, you had recall elections last year involving trustees. None of the trustees were actually recalled, but they kept their posts fairly narrowly. As I recall, the votes were pretty tight. It just gives you a sense that this is a district with a lot of discord and a lot of issues that they're still trying to work their way through. And it begins again. Now they're having to shop around for another superintendent.
Yeah. Okay, Harrison, third time's a charm. We're going to go back to you. We're doing it old school. Right, exactly. You're on the phone, so we're doing this old school. Okay, so so let's get back to this vigil on Tuesday, because I want to know, like, you know, really where that message came from about this being a vigil, not a protest. This was something that the organizers were very firm about in how they wanted this to proceed.
Yes. Well, they had where to even begin with it. I think from the moment that there was a resurgence in local interest in the issue, there was kind of a question about who was going to own that turf, who was going to take a leadership role. And it turned out that a number of people actually managed to step forward. And what we saw at the vigil was very much something that was coordinated with organizers were coordinating with the city. And they managed to own, you know, an emotional corner. They were able to, it was, as far as I can tell, just kind of a fairly small group of people, fairly young, But they did a fairly enormous thing. That said, some of the other demonstrations that have taken place have, you know, really gotten kind of their gotten their oomph from a lot of the anger. And because we have those, because there was that a little bit of a sort of a disconnect in who was actually leading and then owning this issue, we've really seen actions of two different flavors.
And Harrison, because talk a little bit more about that, because so our Heath Druzin was attended the vigil as well, and he said, you know, there were so many things that stuck out to him, but one being how when the vigil was over, you know, the event organizers basically said, like, it's time to go home peacefully, and in fact, pick up your trash before you go. Let's leave things the way they were, and everyone, you know, peacefully disassemble. And for the most part, that happened. However, there was kind of a counter, like basically a protest back at the State House with two groups after, correct? Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's true. I mean, for the last few nights, the Black Lives Matter demonstrators have shown up at the Capitol. They've been waving flags. They've had their chance. And there has also been a police presence there. Obviously, these demonstrations have you know their eyes on the police. This is you know, very much a police issue. That said, there's been a third party in town. We see Patriot and militia types. There are people kind of coming in from out of town because they feel perhaps threatened by the resurgence of Black Lives Matter. And so they're really sort of, you know, three different parties going on the quad, if you'll pardon the expression. And it has gotten very tense. In fact, I would say, in my experience, what I've seen based on my reporting is that much of the tension that takes place out on the Capitol, I mean, even after the vigil itself, wasn't so much between the protesters and the police, but between protesters and the counter-protesters.
Right. And then we've had a couple of incidents so then the night before this vigil, there was a protest where one of the counter protesters, it was an accidental discharge, I believe, of a gun, but was arrested. Yes. And then there's been some graffiti on the State House as well.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that it's interesting to note that, or a few interesting things, everyone who has been arrested, as far as I can tell, has been 18 years old. So I think we're looking at a very young crowd that's out there engaging in some of these more acrimonious counter-protest interactions. The young man whose firearm accidentally discharged, he was arrested and charged with a misdemeanor violation. The graffiti the damage caused by the graffiti is estimated to be in excess of $1,000, which makes it a felony. And you know, from things that I've heard and things that I've seen, people have sort of reacted kind of strongly to the fact that someone who defaced some property is getting a steeper sentence than someone who very well may have been the spark that lit a very dangerous fire at a tense moment.
Well, and we should say, sorry to jump in, but Heath Druzin actually did report earlier this week too that Boise police are now investigating that shooting, that discharge of a weapon, as potentially purposeful and not just accidental.
No, thank you for clarifying that, Jimmy. I think that's really very important, because then that could potentially then change those charges as well. So Harrison, before we move on to some other things, you also wrote an article recently, a piece regarding police violence in America, and talk about that a bit, because I think even your headline, right, is you say, stay angry. America has a real problem with police violence, and it's time to take action. What made you really decide to write, you know, a piece this bold and frankly, a needed piece?
Well, I appreciate that. It's something that I have thought about a great deal going forward, because I wanted to approach that as a piece of straight reporting. And I realized that recently I was involved in something that was a fairly traumatic on a personal level, and I started to notice that telling a story in a straight way, especially when there's so much emotion involved, can be far more difficult, right? And I mm-hmm. in that moment I knew that for me at least the ethical thing to do was to say what I felt. And you know, that particular piece I think had a particular resonance with readers, not so much as a bit about the vigil, but I think people on some level take offense at the idea that it's okay for people to be angry this way, or worry that that kind of anger might spill out into some kind of violence or property damage or what have you, the kind of rioting that we've seen elsewhere. We came very close to having that take place here with the discharge of that firearm the other night. But I mean, it occurs to me that this is a problem that that the police violence is a problem that we have seen over and over and over again. And it's visited Boise, as well. And, it really is time to take a hard look at the issue and ask ourselves, I think, you know, what do we want to get out of the police service? What are the desired outcomes and how do we get there? Because this isn't a system that serves everybody. And if there's one thing that I feel strongly about America is that America ought to be a place for everybody. So I think that's the sort of like ethic that gave birth to this particular opinion piece.
And I think, you know, going back to what you said about people, you know, not understanding or themselves being upset about people being this angry about this. And it kind of, I think, goes back to this idea of the looting and the non-peaceful protesting. When you focus on that, that's just that's putting a Band-Aid over the wound. It's not looking at the disease that created the wound.
Exactly. It's almost a red herring. I mean, people are angry and they'll behave in an angry way. It's unfortunate that people have gotten hurt. It's unfortunate there's been property damage. But I mean, so far, you know, the African American community has been calling for some kind of change to the way that we conduct policing in this country for forever. And I mean, the situation quite simply has not changed. And the more that we capture this video footage of these horrific incidents of police brutality, the more that we need to, that everyone needs to rally around this idea that there is a problem and that we need to solve it. The anger aside, the anger itself is just a symptom of the problem. And it's time to, I think, treat the disease.
Right. I want to move on to some other topics. And Kevin, you literally just came from the Supreme Court. Tell us about the case that you've been covering. Now, this is concerning the State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Sherry Ybarra.
Right. So to clarify, I didn't really just come from the Supreme Court. Everything in 2020 is taking place over Zoom. And what's cool about that is that I was able to cover a Supreme Court hearing in a short sleeve shirt and shorts here in my office. So, but all kidding aside, I mean, this is a really significant lawsuit, a really interesting lawsuit, and a really politically charged lawsuit between State Superintendent Sherry Ybarra and the legislature and the state board. And what this all comes down to is 18 positions within Ybarra's Department of Education that the legislature wants to move to the State Board of Education. They want to take these positions and take the $2.7 million and shift it out of Ybarra's budget and out of Ybarra's bailiwick and put it under the State Board of Education. Ybarra has sued. Her legal arguments are grounded in the Constitution and who has primacy over education policy in the state. But what's been really interesting in these filings, and it didn't come up as much today, is the question of where is this department, where is the elected position of state superintendent in the grand scheme of public policy? Ybarra is suggesting that there are legislators who straight up want to get rid of her department, want to get rid of the elected position of state superintendent. They want to go to an appointed position like most states have. And if they can't do that through amending the state constitution, she's arguing that there are legislators who just basically want to defund her department, gut her department by trimming away functions, trimming away positions as they did this session. There's a flavor of that came up in the hearing this morning. At one point, Chief Justice Roger Burdick was really asking pointed questions of the attorney representing the legislature and saying, well, are you just suggesting that the legislature can go ahead and gut the Department of Education? I mean, is that what you're suggesting that they can do? And in essence, the legislature's attorney was arguing that, well, the superintendent's powers are somewhat limited. She has a seat on the State Board of Education, and she's a constitutional officer. But you know, her argument and the State Board's argument is that the board is the education policymaking entity in the state, and that the Constitution puts that power before the State Board. So really interesting hearing this morning. A lot of pointed questions really directed at all of the attorneys. David Leroy, who's representing Ibarra, State Board's attorney, the legislature's attorney. No idea really of when the State Board will act, but I suspect that they will act fairly quickly because this transfer of positions is supposed to go into effect on July 1st. So I think the State Board knows, I think the Supreme Court rather, knows that the clock is ticking and that to issue a ruling in June is pretty much an imperative. So I would expect a ruling fairly soon.
Well, and you even had Chief...
Oh, go ahead, Chief.
Sorry, I was going to say you even had Chief Justice Burdick and I believe Justice Stegner both say, well, why don't we just implement a stay and temporarily bar this from happening while we kick it down to the district court level?
Right. Yeah, I think that came up of whether there's an evidentiary issue that should go back to the district court. So, yeah, I'll say this for the Supreme Court. I mean, and you were listening to it too, Jimmy, so maybe you had a different read of it. I don't think the justices tipped their hand at all. They were kind of equal opportunity inquisitors this morning. They came after all three attorneys representing all three entities with pretty direct questions. So I couldn't get a really good read about where this court may come down.
Yeah.
So Harrison, in the midst of the vigil that had upwards of 6,000 people attending, and then we've seen other protests happening, we are still dealing with a pandemic. And how was that handled, in particular during the vigil? From everything that I saw, I didn't see one person, at least who was there for the vigil, not wearing a mask, but there was certainly no social distancing.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, anyone who's there or, you know, you can read the coverage. And I, you know, I hope that people kind of mention that fact that we are still in the middle of a pandemic. And you know, there are a lot of conversations going on about how safe can we possibly be during a time of really serious social protest. Like you, I don't think I saw a single person who wasn't wearing a face mask. But again, the opportunities for social distancing were slim to nil. And that's drawn quite a bit of criticism from people. You know, like, we thought we were in a pandemic. We thought we were trying to flatten the curve. And what are all these people doing? And oh, by the way, you know, these other demonstrations have been, you know, criticized for doing exactly the same thing that the Black Lives Matter folk are being lauded for. And I mean, there are a couple of pieces to note there. One, it was totally voluntary for people to go. And this is an issue that really people care about. That said, there's people are absolutely right. Like, you know, if you can stay home, people should stay home. And I think that attendees are starting to, they're wondering what the best decisions are for them as regards to showing support or criticizing this issue, while at the same time, you know, observing the public health rules that have been put in place, those suggestions, social distancing, face masks, washing hands, staying home when you're sick, all that. It bears tremendously on the issue.
Well, and the argument can be made, Harrison, that yes, we're in the middle of a pandemic, but there are two pandemics going on, right? There is coronavirus, and then there is a pandemic of racial injustice that people can argue that has been going on for hundreds of years in this country.
I totally agree. You know, and I mean, I was just talking to someone the other day that, you know, it's so unfortunate that we're going through a pandemic like this, and we're having to constantly be having those conversations about people with, you know, how seriously we want to take this. You know, convincing friends and family to wear face masks when they go out, et cetera. But at the same time, there is this desperate need for change in this country. While we should be focusing on coronavirus, suddenly there's this absolutely disturbing video circulating on the internet showing a police officer with his knee on a black man's neck. And, you know, the end result of that is that the black man dies. And unfortunately, it's all too common an occurrence. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, you are talking about two pandemics, one, you know, social, economic, and political, and the other one of this literal disease.
And speaking of the coronavirus pandemic, Kevin, there are far-reaching effects on this. One of them being, what happens come fall when K through 12, but also higher ed, is set to go back to school. And we at least know at this point, Kevin, a couple of the higher ed institutions here in Idaho have said they're going to open for class. We've not heard anything at this point from K through 12, at least to my knowledge.
Right. So we do have a lot more clarity at this point about what's going to happen at the three state universities. All three plan to reopen in August. Idaho State would reopen on the 17th, and U of I and Boise State would open on August 24th. And they're all talking about more or less the same kind of safeguards. Classes will be moved into larger meeting spaces. Some of the larger classes may move to an online model or a hybrid model where you have some online learning and some face-to-face instruction. Both Idaho State and Boise State want to effectively shut down the fall semester, the campus component of the fall semester, at Thanksgiving break. Students would go home for Thanksgiving break, and they wouldn't come back for the rest of the fall semester. The rest of that semester would take place online. In Idaho State's case, it would be online final exams the week after Thanksgiving. The thinking being is twofold here, that first of all, you don't know what happens with students and what happens with staff when they go home for Thanksgiving break, or they go on a trip for Thanksgiving break. Do they come back to campus infected or asymptomatic? So you want to get on top of that and avoid that sort of spread late in the semester, especially because that would coincide with a potential second wave of coronavirus or the onset of flu season. So both the university is really trying to clamp down on that. Now, you started out talking about K-12. We really don't know what K-12 is going to do. That's still very much up in the air. And, you know, I would not be surprised if we see a lot of variation from community to community, from school to school, and changes over the course of the year. You know, if there's an outbreak in a community, does the local school have to respond with some sort of stay-at-home order where, you know, learning goes to an online model again for a couple of weeks or a few weeks, depending on whether there's a local outbreak. So I think K-12 is a lot harder to figure out at this point. It's a lot harder to get a sense of where it's going at this point because, you know, let's face it, 115 school districts, 60 charters. There's going to be a lot of variation, I suspect. And there's going to be a lot of, you know, differences from community to community about how, you know, how the coronavirus is behaving and spreading.
And Kevin, we do know there are at least two surveys, correct? Parent surveys that have come back. West Ada sent one out to their parents, and then the Boise School District did. And I know at least with the West Ada, some upwards of like 73% of parents who responded said yes, they want schools to be back open in the fall.
I think that that's a pretty widespread sentiment. I think, you know, most parents do want to get back to some sort of a normal, because it's, you know, the optimal way for kids to learn in most cases is for them to be in a classroom. But I wonder what's going to happen in the fall. I do wonder what sort of enrollment trends we see. Do some parents decide to keep their kids at home, whether that means homeschooling or enrolling them in virtual charter schools? So I think those enrollment numbers will be really interesting to track. But I think in general, you're right. I think By and large, most parents want what they had before for their kids, some sort of a face-to-face model.
Well, and Kevin, we also know too that there, I mean, you talk about domino effects, right? That if schools don't reopen, I mean, that affects so many families' financial outlook. Because when we look at people, especially in these essential worker jobs, and they have young children, and there is, you know, not decent day, you know, not daycare options, because some daycares have opened, some haven't. Summer camps, they're hardly any this summer. And then on top of it, if school does not reopen, there are so many tentacles, right, that affect an entire family by schools not being able to open.
Oh, absolutely. Just think of the upheaval we've had in household upon household across the state through nobody's fault. I mean, everybody was responding to a pandemic and a growing public health crisis. So yeah, everybody was having to respond in the moment, but what turmoil and what trauma it caused for parents and for kids. Nobody really wants to revisit that. And everybody wants to get back to some level of normalcy. But what do you do if there's an outbreak, a community outbreak, a localized outbreak? I don't think those answers are clear at this point, but that's something we're certainly going to be asking about in the weeks and months to come.
So no information, I mean, so nothing from any of the school districts at this point as to any type of plan. I mean, granted, we are only 2 weeks into official summer break.
And I think to some degree, the local districts and administrators are probably waiting to see what sort of guidelines, recommendations come from the State Board of Education. We know the State Board is working on this issue. I've been told that the State Board hopes to have some guidelines in place for the fall, in place towards the end of this month, so that parents, teachers, administrators can have a handle of what they can expect, knowing that everything could change.
Yeah. I want to thank all of you for taking time today. Really appreciate all of the reporting all of you do and being able to come on the roundtable and getting everyone updated. We've been talking with Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News, Harrison Berry with the Boise Weekly, and our own James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News. Happy Friday, guys. Hope you have a good weekend.
You too.
Peace out, Gemma.
Peace out, Kevin. This is Idaho Matters.